Ever dodge death over a red scrunchie? Picture racing through Trinidad, Cuba, narrowly missing a taxi while carrying a hair accessory you promised to return to a stranger named Yesenia. As the vehicle whizzes past, your mind floods with absurd worries, dying abroad, family shame, and yes, whether you're wearing acceptable underwear. This isn't the plot of a quirky indie film. It's the moment that transformed Alua Arthur's life and led her to become one of America's most sought-after death doulas. At the bus station afterward, still shaken, Arthur meets Jessica, a German traveler with a red quill pen tattoo who helps delay the bus. As they journey together, Jessica casually reveals she has terminal uterine cancer and is seeing the world before she dies. Unlike Jessica's friends and family who tiptoe around mortality, Arthur leans in with genuine curiosity. The question she asks becomes a turning point. When you look at yourself on your deathbed, who do you see? This simple inquiry unlocks something profound in both women. Jessica realizes she wants to write a book about her travels. Arthur, at 34, contemplates her own mortality for the first time, truly contemplates it, and envisions the person she wants to become before her final breath. Years later, she understands that without this coincidental encounter, she might be dead, not physically, but spiritually crushed under the weight of living someone else's life. Your body tells your story. Every wrinkle maps a smile. Every scar chronicles a fall. As a death doula, Arthur has witnessed this truth thousands of times, bodies transforming from vibrant vessels to empty matter in a single breath. Arthur's body arrived in Ghana weighing 10 pounds, celebrated as a healthy, bufty child. In America, that same body suddenly became something to fear and fix. Now, she's found harmony with her physical self, decorating it boldly with locks, jewelry, and bright colors, refusing to shrink. Despite aging's inevitable markers, she recognizes her body as her most trustworthy companion, performing billions of tasks without thanks or complaint. The body's decline becomes particularly poignant in end-of-life work. Hands that once built houses struggle to hold a spoon. Brilliant minds become confused by simple questions. The body always wins this game we're playing. This isn't pessimism, it's liberation. Acknowledging this truth becomes the first step toward making peace with mortality and living fully while we can. Arthur's earliest memory is escaping death during Ghana's 1981 military coup. At 3 years old, she remembers her father's sweaty hand rushing her down 7 flights of stairs, people panicking. Her father, a prominent government official, was targeted when President Lyman's administration was overthrown. After 5 months in prison, he escaped with help from farmers and fishermen, joining his family in Maryland as a political refugee. At 12, Arthur woke at 4 a.m. for an adventure with her father, a trip to a rural Denver farm for fresh meat. When a loud blast silenced a goat's desperate bleeding, she burst into tears. Unable to reconcile the creature's fear with eating its flesh, she declared herself vegetarian on the spot. This experience revealed her overwhelming empathy, a quality that would both guide and challenge her throughout her life. Arthur's earliest memory is escaping death during Ghana's 1981 military coup. At 3 years old, she remembers her father's sweaty hand rushing her down 7 flights of stairs, people panicking. Her father, a prominent government official, was targeted when President Lyman's administration was overthrown. After 5 months in prison, he escaped with help from farmers and fishermen, joining his family in Maryland as a political refugee. At 12, Arthur woke at 4 a.m. for an adventure with her father, a trip to a rural Denver farm for fresh meat. When a loud blast silenced a goat's desperate bleeding, she burst into tears. Unable to reconcile the creature's fear with eating its flesh, she declared herself vegetarian on the spot. This experience revealed her overwhelming empathy, a quality that would both guide and challenge her throughout her life. When Peter said he was tired, she didn't understand he meant ready to die tired. Those were his last conscious words before dying 3 days later. During his final months with stage 4 Burkitt's lymphoma, Arthur became the first person she doula'd, supporting Peter while fielding 4-year-old Lyle's questions about death, balancing honesty with comfort. Around 3 a.m. on December 11, 2013, 4 days before his 44th birthday, Peter breathed his last. The room filled with deafening stillness until Arthur's sister Bazoma pierced it with a sharp whimper. After Peter's death, Arthur's dining table became littered with colorful sticky notes full of unanswerable questions, contacting credit card companies, cataloging online accounts, figuring out what to do with his clothes. She desperately wished for someone knowledgeable and compassionate to help navigate this maze. Her anger at society's abandonment of the grieving transformed into purpose. If there wasn't someone to call for help, she could become that person for others. Empathy without boundaries can be destructive. During her first year at South Brooklyn Legal Services, Arthur overextended herself, helping Natasha, a 26-year-old Black woman with AIDS who seemed remarkably similar to her. Her supervisor, Cynthia, offered life-changing advice. "Well, Alua, it's not you." She had collapsed the space between herself and Natasha, conflating their experiences. This taught her the crucial difference between empathy and compassion. Empathy says, "I know what you're going through," while compassion acknowledges, "I might not understand exactly, but I'm curious and I'm here with you." The most healing approach? Show up and shut up. Acknowledge the situation, then follow the grieving person's lead. She learned this with Akua, a client with terminal cancer who wasn't ready to discuss death. Rather than forcing confrontation, Arthur respected her timeline. When Akua returned weeks later, she had accepted her approaching death and planned it meticulously, surrounded by purple flowers, Niels Fromm's music, chakra-closing rituals, and loved ones. 6 years into her practice, Arthur meets Justina, a famous self-help guru with 12 days left to live. At their first meeting, Justina sits surrounded by 15 adoring visitors, hair curled, lipstick perfect. Despite her cheerful welcome, Arthur senses profound sadness. By the second visit, the lipstick and visitors are gone, replaced by frustration and tears. "No one understands," Justina repeats. Though surrounded by people, she feels profoundly alone facing mortality. When Justina begins actively dying, dozens of uninvited people show up, turning her death into a spectacle. Death isn't the great equalizer people claim. While we all die, we die of different causes at different rates, reflecting social power dynamics. White women outlive Black women, men die earlier than women, straight people outlive queer folks, and poor people die earlier than wealthy ones. In death care, failing to acknowledge privilege and bias further marginalizes communities at their most vulnerable moments. Arthur recalls Nancy, a 96-year-old former librarian with Alzheimer's, who suddenly asks with disgust, "Wait, are you Black?" The racist outburst reveals how inequities follow us even into death. Acknowledging our unique humanity, not pretending colorblindness, is the best way to achieve that elusive good death. Falling in love feels like tripping over yourself, one of life's messy adventures and greatest joys. It also creates paralyzing fear as we become aware of our mortality and our beloveds. Arthur met Kip at a Hollywood gas station, 6'2", dark-skinned, with locks down his back. He proposed on the freeway. 3 months after their Costa Rica elopement, discovering he didn't use flat sheets triggered an existential crisis about compromise. 6 months later, they separated. The breakup was excruciating. Now, 15 years later, they remain good friends. Arthur's seen this with clients like Elena and Mike. After Mike died from ALS, Elena struggled to adapt. For almost 2 years, her entire existence focused on Mike's care. Less than a year after his death, Elena died of a heart attack. Arthur believes she died of a broken heart. In her work, Arthur offers clients finding your feet, through a warm foot bath or placing bare feet on the earth to ground them in the present moment where they can affirm, "Today, I am here." However you find genuine love, you should take it and give it because eventually we all die. On her first day as a real lawyer, Arthur stared at her frosted glass door with "Alua Arthur, Attorney" in adhesive letters. She tested if they could be removed, already sensing she didn't want to be a lawyer, a truth that would take 9 exhausting years to fully face. She'd become a lawyer because she was a gifted child, expected to do big things, because it sounded good, and she wanted to make her family proud. Her senior attorney, Sylvia, cut straight to the heart. Why are you a lawyer? Arthur shopped for drab lawyer clothes, heather gray suits and pinstripes, instead of orange Alexander McQueen skirts or mud cloth capes. Grays and blacks replaced vibrant colors. The spark faded from her life. She was slowly killing herself, shrinking her joy for a life she didn't buy into. 8 months before her life fell apart, budget cuts meant working full-time at the self-help center in Inglewood Courthouse, eliminating the only part of her job that still nourished her. Within 3 therapy sessions, she was diagnosed with dysthymia, upgraded 3 months later to major depression. Her 6 months at the dungeon were barely survivable, days in a windowless basement office, nights alone drinking wine and smoking hash to numb her thoughts. At Burning Man, curiosity rekindled. Driving back to Los Angeles, she received a voicemail that legal aid needed her at the dungeon for another 3 to 6 months. "I'm never stepping foot in that place again. I'll die if I do," she told her friends. Having glimpsed what life could be, she couldn't go back. After Peter's death, she followed her grief-filled curiosity, completing death midwifery training and formalizing Going with Grace in 2015. When Leslie, a 67-year-old woman with terminal lung disease, asks Arthur, "What does dying feel like?" she cuts through years of avoidance with startling directness. Arthur admits she doesn't know from personal experience. Leslie's follow-up, "What happens after death?" receives the same honest answer. The 5W questions we learn in school fail us when applied to death. Everyone dies, but when, where, and why remain fundamentally unknowable. Death drives us into the discomfort of "I don't know," which explains why many cling to what they think they can control. Arthur has learned she can't provide certainty. She can only be present as clients create their own answers while surrendering to the unknown. This principle applies to life itself. When we open ourselves to not knowing, we find where all the juice lies. Certainty makes us rigid. Embracing uncertainty opens us to boundless potential. Arthur thinks about her death almost daily, sometimes from near misses, sometimes from witnessing others die, sometimes because her entire life leads to that mystifying moment. Though none of us knows what follows death, we can choose anticipation over dread. Many reach life's end still ruminating on what they were supposed to do. While living, we can create a life we feel comfortable dying from, untangling ourselves from others' expectations. Our death denial makes us behave like we'll live forever, but we don't have forever to create the life we want. So make the banana bread, scream into pillows, take naps, eat cake, forgive yourself, apologize to those you've hurt, tell your truth, tell people you love them. Do whatever you must to reconcile your life with your death today. Because the greatest tragedy isn't dying, it's reaching the end and realizing you never truly lived.